If you've been watching or listening to the news this week, then you've probably heard this.
Telling the truth. What you are doing is allowing someone who actually violated a woman to sit in the Supreme Court.
This is the voice of Ana Maria Archila, who, along with another activist, Maria Gallagher, intercepted Republican Senator Jeff Flake while he was in an elevator in a Senate office building. Flake had just announced that he would vote to confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
Violating a young girl. What are you doing, sir?
I was sexually assaulted and nobody believes me.
The two women demanded that Flake consider what his vote would mean for women, women like them who had survived sexual assault.
You're going to ignore them. That's what happened to me, and that's what you're telling all women in America.
Later that same Friday, Jeff Flake backpedaled and asked for a delay of the Senate vote on Kavanaugh's confirmation, pending an FBI investigation. Now, that elevator clip has ricocheted across the news and social media, and it's become emblematic of this moment in our national conversation where many women are demanding that their personal experiences of sexual assault be taken seriously. So we reached out to Ana Maria Archila. She's a Colombian immigrant, an American citizen, and she runs a nonprofit national advocacy group called the Center for Popular Democracy. It turns out that Ana Maria had been preparing for that moment in the elevator for most of her life.
Senator Flake, do you think that Brett Kavanaugh is telling the truth?
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with activist Ana Maria Archila. Ana Maria, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much.
I want to know your arrival story.
I grew up in Colombia during a moment in history when Colombia was incredibly violent. My father was a student activist and my mother is a nurse. And my father's activism forced him to leave the country, like so many people in the early 90s. He eventually moved to New York City in maybe 1991. And I had been coming to visit him once a year ever since. I finally decided to come and be with him when I was 17. So I came to the U.S. initially just to learn English. I was supposed to be here just for 6 months, like so many people who come and say, I'm just going to do this one thing and go back home. And I ended up staying.
So what was it about this country that made you say, I'm going to leave my homeland?
I had never experienced kind of the safety of walking in the streets and not feeling afraid. So that was a new experience when I moved here. Definitely migrating was the most challenging experience, both feeling like no one knows me. If I disappear in the streets of New York City, only my dad will know. So feeling so anonymous in some ways was incredibly sad and also created a sense of freedom, I think, at the time. I was a teenager and I felt like, oh, this is kind of my opportunity to like be who I want to be without the kind of control that gets built around you and in every society.
I mean, at what point does it just come be like, okay, I think I'm going to actually put some roots down?
The roots were definitely planted for the first time firmly in 2001. In the summer of 2001, I started teaching English in a tiny storefront in this neighborhood called Port Richmond. Lots of young people who were working as day laborers, who were working in the kitchens, working 12 hours a day. And after those 12 hours, they would come to my tiny storefront and take English classes. And it was incredibly moving to be in the presence of people who had dreams, who said, I want to learn English and I'm going to buy myself a motorcycle and I'm going to do this. And it was really meeting them that allowed me to imagine that I could be useful to my community. I'll tell you a story. So there are two young people who I credit for really helping me kind of set my path. Crisóforo and his cousin. They were both 15 years old. They worked in the deli across the street from my office, 12 hours a day in the back of the kitchen cutting meats. Children are not supposed to do that job. They would come to ESL classes and they would work 6 days a week. And then sometimes on Sunday, their boss would take them home and ask them to help him do construction work. So they were working for free on Sundays and getting paid $3 an hour. Obviously, incredibly abusive. But the thing that was most insulting to them was that the boss called both of them Pancho. He didn't even learn their names. He didn't bother. And I said, you and I are gonna set this course correct. And I was able to help them sue the boss, get thousands and thousands of dollars back in stolen wages. And really, I think Crisoforo was the same age as my brother. My brother was 15 at the time. And I remember thinking, Crisoforo is my brother. Like, he's my brother.
How does Make the Road end up being a part of your life?
So Make the Road by Walking was an organization of Latino immigrants rooted in Bushwick in Brooklyn. The name of their organization comes from a poem that I read and loved as a teenager, one by Antonio Machado. The verse in Spanish is, Caminante no hay camino, se hace camino al andar. Searcher, there is no road, we make the road by walking. And so I fell in love with the organization before I knew the people there. And when I met them, I said, oh my God, these people are my family. And then in 2006, when Congressman Sensenbrenner introduced really offensive anti-immigrant legislation.
There have obviously been a number of allegations that HR 4437 is on its face racist. They've accused you of being racist. Yeah. Obviously, there's a...
I'll put my record against anybody else's record in Congress.
Millions of people marched across the country. Millions of immigrants came out of the shadows, walked out of their jobs, walked out of schools, across the country, everywhere.
We are the people from the United States.
The leaders of Make the Road by Walking and I decided that we were going to do a march together.
So those huge national public manifestations of immigrants across the country in 2006 left a big imprint on you.
Oh, it was my first and most important sense of movement.
So on Friday, September 28th, you made a road, a beeline, actually, to target Senator Flake. And as a result of that, you made a narrative road that nobody could have imagined.
So the story of Friday begins many months ago. The Trump election, I think, just created a sense of kind of unveiling of the ugly underbelly of the country. A lot of people poured out into the streets the day after inauguration, marched with the Women's March. My organization, the Center for Popular Democracy, which is a network of community organizations, of which Make the Road is one, had been training people across the country for months in this tactic that we call bird dogging.
Bird dogging.
Bird dogging.
What?
It's... Bird dogging apparently is the name of this tactic where you just force human interaction with an elected official. You just show up at their offices and you say, hey, I'm here. I want to talk to you right now. I know you're there. Let me tell you my story right now.
And you learned how to do this? Somebody?
A colleague of mine, Jennifer Flynn, she's the one who taught me about bird dogging, and she went across the country training people. She sent emails to her friends and said, if you can put 15 people in a room, I will come to you and train you on bird dogging tactics and civil disobedience. She could fly everywhere because her mom was a flight attendant. And so she can fly everywhere for free. So she just went everywhere across the country and trained thousands of people in bird dogging. And then those folks said, we want to become a community. And they named their community the Bird Dog Nation.
Do you remember the thing that you remember the most that impacted you when you first experienced bird dogging?
A colleague, his name is Addie Barkin. He was diagnosed with ALS, and he went to D.C. for the first time to fight the tax bill, to tell his story. When Addie was flying back home to Santa Barbara, where he lives, he bumped into Senator Jeff Flake on a plane, and he bird dogged Senator Flake in that plane.
So what happens, what should I tell my son, or what should you tell my son if you pass this bill and he cuts funding for disability?
And told him, said, Senator Flake, I am dying of ALS. If you vote for the tax bill, you will take away my disability payments, you will take away my health care, and I will not be able to be around for my son to grow up. I need you to be a hero. And that moment, that interaction went viral.
Next guest made headlines when he confronted a Republican senator on an airplane about the upcoming vote on the latest version of this Republican tax bill.
And thousands of people then began to follow Addie's steps and come to Washington, D.C. To fight the tax bill.
Thanksgiving break, there have been more than 100 demonstrations already targeting Republican lawmakers.
Many of those people came back to join the members of United We Dream to fight for DACA.
Also known as Dreamers. Well, protesters formed a human chain across Pennsylvania Street, linking arms outside Senator Joe Donnelly's office, like you see.
Many of them came back to join the Women's March.
Organizers were just hoping to get about 200,000, but they've gotten more than 200,000.
To fight against the separation of children at the border. And many of these folks have been in Washington, D.C. the last several weeks, bird-dogging members of Congress, following their senators to try to force in-person interactions with them and to tell them their stories.
Why won't you look at her?
We would like to know if you believe survivors of sexual violence.
Clearly, you're okay if a rapist goes on the Supreme Court.
And so that's how I ended up in D.C. this week.
And I'm sure that there are people who are saying, I'm hearing bird dogging and I'm feeling uncomfortable. Is it about confronting, jumping, taking on, being confrontational?
No, it's not. It's not about being confrontational. It's about seeking connection. It's about allowing elected officials to remember who they represent, to connect their humanity to your humanity. Maria was yelling at Senator Flake in the elevator. She was saying, look at me. Look at me when I'm talking to you. Is basically what movements do every time.
Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter, that what happened to me doesn't matter.
The civil rights movement was about the country looking at the violence. It was about people looking at African-American men and women in this country who were being beaten down by police and saying, look at me. Let's connect on a human level and hear my story.
Coming up on Latino USA, my conversation with Ana María Archila continues. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR Spanish language podcast Radio Ambulante. We're back with a new season with 36 stories from all over Latin America and the Latino community here in the U.S., from one of the most controversial trials in Puerto Rico's history to the Venezuelan migrant crisis. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we're back, and we're going to continue now with our conversation with Ana María Archila.
On Monday, I stood in front of your office with Addie Barkin. I told the story of my sexual assault. I told it because I recognized in Dr. Ford's story that she's telling the truth.
So I went to Washington, D.C. earlier in the week to join many of the people from the Bird Dog Nation and community organizations from across the country and Women's March and women's organizations. And Addie, my friend Addie, who now is on a wheelchair and has a really hard time speaking, I thought Addie was going to speak, and he said, no, you go. So in that moment, I began to tell my story
in front of Monday.
In that moment, I began to tell my story for the first time in my life.
So no one, who knew about the fact that you...
I had... told a few people, some of my best friends.
This was not something that was kind of on your biography?
No, not at all. I was asking myself the question of whether I wanted to tell my story or not. And in that moment, I just went with it. And I said, you know, I was 5, he was 15. And I shared at that time when I was 5 with 2 adults, not my parents, who either didn't believe me or didn't know what to do with that information. They never did anything. So then I just understood the lesson that we are not believed. And this boy understood the lesson that boys will be boys. And I don't want my children to learn that lesson. I want to believe that in our country, we actually listen to survivors. It was a very painful moment. I cried after because I realized, oh my God, maybe my father will hear it this way. Maybe my mother will hear it this way. And then it didn't reach them. But then on Friday, I texted my dad right after the interaction with Flake, and I said, you might hear something in the news. I want you to know that I am okay. And he said, I'm sorry, I was not able to protect you. And I said to him, it was not your fault and it's not my fault. And I feel very supported by you. But you know, that fear was confirmed. I didn't tell my story because I didn't want him and other people who love me to have to hold that pain. And I'm not doing it alone. Like, I'm doing it with all these women. I feel so much in community with thousands of women I have never met, but whose stories I deeply, deeply understand.
When you see what happened in the moment with Senator Flake, how do you connect that to the kind of activism that you've been doing and developing on immigration? How do those two worlds come together in that moment for you?
If there has been a movement that has deployed the power of storytelling to transform the consciousness of a nation, is the immigrant rights movement, and especially young people who came out of the shadows to tell their stories. And many of those young people have been young women leaders. They have kind of demonstrated what it looks like to fight both for the country and for your own life, and how those two things are one and the same. And young people in Arizona and across the country actually convinced Senator Flake to be one of their allies in the Republican Party. A lot of the conversation about survivors has centered or the stories of women kind of without talking about the rest of their experience of who we are. I can't separate me being a woman from being Latina, from being an immigrant, from being a mother, and now accepting and embracing this other part of my identity as a survivor. I think the history of this country is a history of the struggle for inclusion, of more of us and the promise of freedom.
The act of bird-dogging Senator Flake, people will say it is your most overt political act. In some deeply human ways, it's the least political act.
Yeah. I think it was the mother in me, honestly, that came out. There is a quote by a Sikh activist, Valerie Kaur. So the mother in me asks, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if America is not dead, but a country waiting to be born? What does the midwife say? She says, when we are in labor, she says, breathe, and then push. Because if we don't breathe, we die. If we don't push, we die. If we don't push, America dies. But if we push with our labor and our love and our vision, we will bring this country into existence.
Ana Maria Archila, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Ana Maria Archila is co-director of the Center for Popular Democracy, a national nonprofit advocacy group. This episode was produced by Antonia Cerejido and edited by Marlon Bishop. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Maggie Freely, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri and Maya Cueva. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman and Graham Ball at the studios at Harvard University. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Moura and Comis Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Xenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here. And on the next How I Built This, how Sandy Lerner helped launch one of the most successful tech companies in the world, Cisco Systems, why she had to leave it, and how she went on to remake herself again and again and again. You can find How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.